Brothers and sisters, as I'm sure you all know, this evening Brother Howard Cook is to give us an address on the life and work of Brother Robert Roberts. And so now I will hand the meeting over to Brother Howard.
My dear brothers and sisters, tonight we're to talk about the life and work of Robert Roberts, 1839 to 1898. And first of all, here are two fairly objective assessments of his work, of his role. The man generally considered to have continued the work of organising and establishing the Christadelphian movement founded by Dr. John Thomas. And then the organising ability of Robert Roberts was very important. He gave the movement its rules, institutions, and much of its literature. Indeed, it has been said that were it not for Robert Roberts, the Christadelphian community would not have survived, or would not long have survived, the death of John Thomas. Is that okay? Is it right? Is it technology? Okay. Yeah. Just to reiterate that point, were it not for Robert Roberts, the Christadelphian community would not long have survived the death of John Thomas. It would have disappeared were it not for the man we're going to be talking about this evening, the brother that we're going to be talking about this evening. And we can now see from our perspective in time that that was the providential role of this remarkable man. Well, starting off then with his birth. Birthplace was Link Street, Aberdeen. He was an Aberdonian. His father was the captain of a coasting vessel, a sea captain. His mother, a school teacher, and the daughter of a London merchant. She was also a very strongly religious Calvinistic Baptist. In all, the family were of lowly circumstances, but well-disciplined, strictly religious. That was the environment in which Robert Roberts, his sister and his brothers were brought up. Well, this is the chapel in Aberdeen where he first heard John Thomas speaking in 1849, aged 10 years old. This wasn't the occasion we might expect it to have been. He describes John Thomas as a quiet, stern, firm, neatly made gentleman with a jet black beard. The address on baptism had not struck me at all. I had, in fact, wearied and slept under it, and was glad when it was over. This is the reaction, perhaps the normal reaction, of a 10-year-old to a lecture on baptism. In fact, Robert Roberts was developing. He was developing a faith of some kind. Aged 12, he became a full member of his mother's church, this Calvinistic Baptist church in Aberdeen. But shortly afterwards, he came across a copy of a magazine belonging, in fact, to his sister, who was quite a few years older than he was, the Herald of the Kingdom and the Age to Come, which was produced by John Thomas. And it was under the influence of that magazine that he began his Bible studies in earnest. He had been reading quite a lot about Christianity as a member of his mother's church, But now he started to go back to the Bible. And he also began meeting with what we would now describe as a small Christadelphian community. This is a photograph of Wallace Tower in Old Castle Aberdeen. Tower structure with a curved roof at the top, and in fact the second floor of that tower was the first meeting room of a group of brethren and sisters, some 18 to 20 persons. And in 1853, aged 13, he became a regular attender there. But the key experience, the key moment in his conversion to the truth, was his discovery of Elpis Israel by John Thomas. He discovered from letters published in the Herald, the magazine that his sister had given him, he discovered that he had written this very large book. And as he describes it in his autobiography, this was a joyful discovery. I felt a strong desire to read it, but I could not get at it. And it was only through the kind offices of an elderly lady, Mrs. Isabel Smith, who lived in the same tall block of flats that Robert Roberts and his family lived in, that he was able to obtain a copy of this book. And he then goes on to say, "I never experienced a purer pleasure than when I commenced with the majestic opening sentences." He carried on unceasingly reading this long book as his leisure hours enabled him to, until I got through it, while causing me to lose all taste for the religious literature which had for 6 months been my substance. The effect of reading Elpis Israel with Bible in hand was to impart a keen interest in the Bible, which before had been uninteresting to me, and to lead me to its daily, early and persevering perusal. Well, after reading Elpis Israel, as we indicated earlier, he ceased attending the chapel with his family, the chapel that his mother took his family to. And then in 1853, aged 14, he was baptized as part of a group called the Baptized Believers. Remember, this was 11 years before the name Christadelphian was coined by John Thomas. And it's also interesting to note that on his own admission, in an article in the Christadelphian in 1874, he was rebaptized. He insisted on being rebaptized in 1863, some 10 years later, on attaining to an understanding of the things concerning the name of Jesus, of which he was ignorant at his first immersion. This is an indication of his scrupulousness in determining and being baptized into the true faith of the Bible. And just to complete his future life in the truth, in April 1859, he married Jane Norrie in Edinburgh. That's a photograph of Robert Roberts and Jane Norrie on their wedding day. Robert was in fact only aged 20, and Jane was 27 years older. She was just a few years older than he was. The beginning of a very happy and profitable union, although it had its sadnesses. They had 6 children in all, but as was quite commonplace in Victorian times, sadly, only 3 of those 6 children survived into adulthood. And we must mention here something that perhaps the first important publication that Robert Roberts developed, which was, of course, the Bible Companion, which he developed about this time, in 1854, when he was aged only 15. It's, as of course I'm sure we well know, it's a reading plan to facilitate, in his case initially, his daily systematic reading of the scriptures. Originally, it was in fact in seven portions. And originally, we believe he produced it in manuscript form. Originally, he produced it for himself. But then, with requests from other brothers and sisters, he produced, I think, handwritten copies initially, and then he got a few copies printed, and it sort of mushroomed from that. And later, it was published as the Bible Companion. And he realised that seven portions was just a bit too much, and it was finally, the final version, was the three-portion version that we are familiar with, later published as the Bible Companion, still used by Christadelphians today. And, of course, this is what Robert Roberts later wrote in his introduction to the completed printed version. The infallible advice to every man and woman anxious about their salvation is read the scriptures daily. It is only in proportion as this is done that success may be looked for. The man who sows sparingly in this respect will only reap sparingly. Well, that then is the beginning of his life in the truth. A very precocious beginning, we might say, to his life as a brother of Christ. But of course, he had to keep body and soul together. He had to earn his living, coming from comparatively humble background. And in fact, he left school when he was 11 years old, which was quite normal for someone of his station in life at that time. We imagine that he must have had certainly a good foundation in the three R's, and obviously somebody with great potential, as we will see. His first job, in fact, was deputising for his brother as a clerk in a rope factory. We'll be looking at that later. Then he became, age 13, apprenticed to a druggist, a pharmacist, and then he started taking lessons in Latin and also in Pitman's shorthand, and that was to have a very great effect on his future career as a journalist, as a writer and a journalist, a fairly important skill in that profession at that time, something he became very proficient in. And this is what Brother Roberts says in his autobiography about the world of work that he was being introduced into. He says his first experience of work was in filling for his brother Arthur's place while he was either unwell or sent somewhere else by his employers. That was to be the clerk or keeper of a rope seller in a rope factory. It involved keeping a record on a slate, in fact, of presumably the ropes that was being manufactured and used. He then goes on to say, it seemed very interesting work, as all work does to all boys, till they get enough of it and more, and get to know what life as it now is really means. A struggle, a scramble, a merciless competition for mere liberty to exist, a state of affairs due to the larger and earlier circumstance that God has hid his face from the human race for a season because of sin and left them to look after themselves, which they are not fit to do. That's his assessment, perhaps looking back with hindsight, of work, the world of work, as he experienced it. And, well, perhaps if we're just some of us here may just be starting out on in the world of work. We might think that that's perhaps rather an extreme view of what it's like to earn one's daily living. But perhaps those of us who've spent a lifetime working, perhaps still continue to work, that is actually quite a fair assessment of the grim reality of being a wage slave, earning our living. And then he goes on to say, the work in the rope cellar did not last long as my brother returned to his place. So that was his first experience of earning his living. And then in 1856, age 17, he had his first position as a journalist, something that he was very well trained for, having learnt shorthand, which was a vital skill in that profession, as indeed I think it still is. And as we will see, he was quite a proficient practitioner in the art of shorthand. And this was in Cornwall's printing shop above a chemist. You'll see the bottom left-hand corner there. Above was Cornwall's printing press. And it was a printing press like that rather crude printing press that we might, as we might regard it today, that he began his career as a journalist, turning out, I think, weekly news sheets, presumably producing the copy, writing it, and then running off these news sheets. And then he went on to develop his career as a shorthand writer and as a reporter. When he was 17, he became a shorthand writer for the Aberdeen Daily Telegraph. And then he became a casual reporter. One example of the sort of things that he covered in that position was a visit of Ferdinand de Lesseps to Aberdeen. Ferdinand de Lesseps was the engineer who went on to build the Suez Canal. And he assisted in reporting speeches in investigating the merits of the Suez Canal scheme conducted by Aberdeen Town Council. I'm not quite sure what their interest was in the Suez Canal, perhaps as a shipping port. But it's rather interesting that some 30 or more years later, Robert Roberts himself, as we will see, was to travel along the Suez Canal in his visits to Australia and New Zealand at the end, towards the end of his life. So that's an example of the kind of thing that he reported as a casual reporter. And then he went to Edinburgh as a reporter on the Caledonian Mercury. And then in 1848 to Huddersfield, where he joined the Huddersfield Examiner. And of course, in the next year, 1859, he had married, as we've seen. And in fact, that's a picture of the premises of the Huddersfield Examiner, where he spent the next few years. A typical sort of newspaper premises of the time. We should remember that this was the great era of newspapers. Every town or village had one reporting the news and other things as well fairly regularly. So there was a potential there for a good journalist. And in fact, his career started to burgeon. For example, he was engaged by two American phrenologists, Orson Squire Fowler and Samuel R. Wells, and they gave him an assignment to travel with them as a shorthand writer for a lecture tour that they were engaged in between 1859 and 1860. Phrenology is a very Victorian science. But perhaps today we might, I'm sure we would regard it as a bit of a pseudo-science, trying to show that the shape of one's head determines one's characteristics, character, abilities and propensities and so on. Today it's been largely, I think, discredited by modern neuroscience, but then many people believed in it, including actually Robert Roberts. It left his, what he's, he heard of what they were saying, left him convinced of the value of phrenology. So that's an example of one assignment that came his way. And he then returned to the Huddersfield Examiner, and he also became the Huddersfield correspondent for the Leeds Mercury, the Halifax Courier, and the Manchester Examiner. So there was quite a potential there for a good shorthand journalist. And in fact, just to continue with his career, just to fill in the rest of his career, as it were, he moved to Birmingham, 1863-4, largely at the suggestion of John Thomas, in fact, during his second visit to England, which we will be talking about in a moment. And he began with a very unsuccessful attempt at creating a general reporting stroke advertising agency with a partner. He describes in his autobiography how they sat in an empty office waiting for people to turn up to employ them, and no one did. That was how unsuccessful it was. But then he became a reporter for the Birmingham Daily Post in 1864, a very good job that would have been, on the basis of a testimonial from John Bright, the local MP. But of course, this kind of work, although very successful from a human point of view, it didn't give him very much time for his activities in the truth, which were becoming increasingly important to him. And fortunately, from 1865 to 1870, he got a job as a reporter for the Birmingham Bankruptcy Court. And apparently in the bankruptcy law of the time, it was important that somebody should keep a verbatim report of the proceedings. So that was what he did for those 5 years. And it may not have been particularly interesting work, but it was very regular work with a fairly limited number of hours, which gave him plenty of spare time, plenty of free time. But unfortunately, in 1870, there was a change in the law which meant that there was no longer this requirement. So his job just finished, his appointment finished. But help was at hand. From 1870 onwards, he was actually given a salary for his editorship of the Christadelphian. Again, this was Dr. Thomas's suggestion. He had already, as we will see, begun the magazine some 6 years before, unpaid. But from now, 1870 onwards, he was to get a salary, not a large salary, but a salary for editing that periodical, that magazine, thus ending his career as a reporter, as a journalist. Well, we've mentioned John Thomas and Robert Roberts, and perhaps we could now look at the association between these two men. John Thomas became something of a mentor to Robert Roberts. Beginning in 1856, when Robert Roberts first wrote to John Thomas in America, he was only 15 at the time, a letter in which he opened his heart, well, in fact, it was actually published in John Thomas's magazine, in which Robert Roberts expressed his faith in the truth and his appreciation of the importance of what John Thomas was doing. And this is how one writer comments on Dr. Thomas's reaction to this communication. As far as the doctor was concerned, here was a youth in Great Britain, only 15 years old, who could write. It was a very eloquent letter, who was full of enthusiasm for the scriptures, and who at such an early age could stand for the principles of the truth against both parents and friends. Well, very early then, almost immediately, John Thomas realized that here was a very special kind of person who had just come into the truth, a very special kind of young man who had come into the truth in Britain. And indeed, in 1858, Robert Roberts tried but failed to raise funds for a second visit of John Thomas to Britain. Remember, he had first come to Britain in the 1840s. Well, between 1861 and 1865, that terrible cataclysmic war in the United States took place, the American Civil War, which split the Union in half, splitting the Christadelphian community in half as well. And it was during that war that the name Christadelphian, as we heard last week, was first coined. Robert Roberts urged John Thomas. They were obviously in fairly fairly close correspondence. He urged John Thomas to visit Britain in 1862, and that visit did actually happen. It lasted until about 1864 and 5. And John Thomas travelled quite extensively around Britain, but when not travelling, he stayed with Robert and Jane Roberts in Huddersfield, where they had long conversations, Robert Roberts and John Thomas, during of which Robert Roberts took quite extensive shorthand notes, and that became the basis of his later book, Dr. Thomas, His Life and Work, which he produced in 1873, 2 years after his death. We are told, sadly, that there were misunderstandings. Remember, John Thomas was meeting with many other brethren and sisters, not all of them approving of Robert Roberts for various reasons. We are told that there was a short breach which was resolved in October 1864, and subsequently they both they enthusiastically supported each other's work. That's a picture of John Thomas, aged 57, on his second visit to Britain. Well, this is a picture of Huddersfield Square, which is Huddersfield was where Robert and his wife Jane lived for 3 or 4 very happy years. They had a very happy relationship with their brothers and sisters at Huddersfield and also with the neighbouring Halifax Ecclesia. And Huddersfield Square became the focus of very persistent outdoor preaching efforts on the part of Robert Roberts, which began in 1860. He regularly used to engage in outdoor speaking in that public place on a Sunday afternoon. And where he could, he also had lectures in a hall. And in 1861, a series of 12 lectures were given by Robert Roberts on successive Sunday afternoons, systematically setting out Christadelphian beliefs, later published as Christendom Astray. And that actually is a picture of Jane Roberts, Sister Jane Roberts, slightly later on, after moving to Birmingham, something which happened 1863 to 1864. As we saw earlier, he took up work as a journalist in Birmingham. Again, interestingly, it was John Thomas's suggestion that they should move from Huddersfield to Birmingham. He quite clearly saw the important role that Robert Roberts could fulfil, this very dynamic young man in a centre like Birmingham. Bearing in mind, he was still a very young man. He was only 24. His age was 24. And then in 1864, the next year, age 25, he began his work as editor initially of something called the Ambassador of the Coming Age. That's the first edition of that magazine, which continued for a few years from 1864. And in fact, in 1869, Dr. Thomas urged Robert Roberts, because he realised the importance of this magazine. He could see what Robert Roberts was about and the value of what he was doing. Dr. Thomas urged him to change the name of the magazine to The Christadelphian, which of course is what it became and has continued to be right down to the 20th century. That was in 1869. It seems that Dr. Thomas was very worried that somebody else, perhaps less well qualified than Robert Roberts, might start a magazine with that title. But he was very anxious that it should be Robert Roberts who would produce a magazine with that title. So that's why he urged him to create, or rather to change the title in that way. Well, Birmingham, under the leadership of Robert Roberts, the ecclesia there expanded. The number of brethren and sisters there expanded. I think by 1866 they numbered something like 68 members, which was quite a large number for an early ecclesia at that time. And Birmingham Town Hall became the focus of preaching efforts. They started arranging what we would call special efforts in that very large town hall, which could accommodate 2,000 plus people. Not only the Christadelphians, of course, were using the Birmingham Town Hall. The picture below, the Temperance Hotel opposite the Birmingham Town Hall, is an interesting picture because it is very germane to an incident that occurred in 1866, where the Millerites, they were the precursors of the Seventh-day Adventists, were having a special public lecture in the Birmingham Town Hall. The Birmingham Town Hall is on the left of the picture and the Temperance Hotel is on the right. And you can see there's a bit of a square in between. And this lecture was so popular that there was quite an overflow crowd outside the Birmingham Town Hall. And Robert Roberts seized the opportunity. He grabbed a chair or something, soapbox or something, and he started addressing this overflow crowd about the truth, preaching the truth to them. And of course, members of the crowd didn't really like what he was telling them, and they became rather angry with this young man who was preaching to them. And a policeman had to escort Robert Roberts, had to be called, and he escorted Robert Roberts into the Temperance Hotel, where he took refuge. So that illustrates the quite rumbustious kind of preaching that he was engaged in the open air, first initially at Huddersfield and then in Birmingham. In fact, this is how one writer puts it. Robert Roberts, this is his preaching ability, Robert Roberts was the only one in the city, The only Christadelphian in the city, that's Birmingham, who had the capacity to speak without notes or preparation, to quote scriptures from memory, and to handle the hecklers who were always to the front of open-air meetings. Perhaps we should just note here at this particular point, because John Thomas had returned to the United States, continuing association that Robert Roberts had with his mentor. He was instrumental in collecting subscriptions and organising the distribution of Eureka, which John Thomas was producing at this time. And then in 1868, he raised funds for his last visit to England. And it was during this trip that Robert Roberts was made the custodian of all his affairs after his death, which happened in 1871. So that's an indication of the great value that John Thomas placed on Robert Roberts, the young Robert Roberts, his ability and his trustworthiness and his worth. And in fact, in March 1871, John Thomas died, something that Robert Roberts describes when he heard the news as one of the saddest days of his life. And that's his burial and gravestone in New York, his gravestone in New York, his burial having been organised by Robert Roberts, who crossed the Atlantic to organise matters in New York, aged only 32, still quite young, or passing the cusp of youth, perhaps. And he also engaged, while he was in America, with the first of several lecturing tours of the United States and Canada. Well, this photograph actually is a record. This is an indication, perhaps, of the increasing size of the Christadelphian community back in the United Kingdom. This photograph is the first Christadelphian fraternal, which was held at Alton in Birmingham in August 1872, the following year. In fact, as we heard 2 weeks ago, that building was in fact a house that had been built for John Thomas to live in, were he to settle in Britain, which in fact John Thomas was hoping to do in 1871, but alas, his death forestalled that event. Presumably the house was still owned by some members of the community. Perhaps it was unfinished at the time, and it became the venue for this first Christadelphian fraternal. I believe that the a third of the way in from the left-hand side, our left-hand side of the picture, there's a little group, including David Handley of the Malden Ecclesia, who I believe was the first member of the Handley family to become a Christadelphian, Brother Turney, and also Robert Roberts as well. I believe David Handley is one of those tall figures on the back row. So that's it, the first Christadelphian fraternal. And at this time, the Birmingham Ecclesia was becoming increasingly active with Robert Roberts as its member, as a leading member, and a very active member of it. It moved to larger premises, a larger hall. In 1866, it leased the Athenaeum Chambers in Birmingham, and in 1871 it moved to Temperance Hall, where it was based for a number of years. But although based in Birmingham, Robert Roberts travelled widely around the country, preaching and supporting a growing number of ecclesias. And now if we could just look at a few of the innovations that Robert Roberts encouraged in this, in the growing community of Christadelphians. The first thing he developed for the Birmingham Ecclesia was a set of ecclesial rules. And this is how he describes the rationale behind what he was suggesting for this growing ecclesia. He said, bearing in mind that he had quite a leading position in the ecclesia because of his personality and his ability, perhaps a lesser man might have tried to seize on to a position of authority within the community as a result. But he says that instead of accepting a position of personal authority, I drew up a set of rules for consideration which would have the effect of putting the body in complete charge of its own affairs. They were adopted and remain the basis of ecclesial operations to the present day. He goes on to say, it was not admiration that led me to propose it, but the perception of the necessity for it when there is no basis for the exercise of divine authority. As with his mentor, John Thomas, Robert Roberts never claimed any personal spiritual authority for himself. He was just a Bible student amongst other Bible students. And so that led him to realize the importance of a democratic system of operation. The aim was to combine liberty with order and law with the absence of authority, and above all to preserve the fraternal character required by the law of Christ. And in fact, those rules were developed, published, circulated, republished, and eventually in their final form they became the guide to the formation and conduct of Christadelphian ecclesias, published in 1883. And this next quotation, I think, is quite significant because this is a quotation from the Rakow Catechism of 1574. The beliefs of a group of brethren in Christ in the 16th century Poland, whom we would today recognize as being fellow believers in the gospel. Robert Roberts would not at that time have known of their existence or what their beliefs were, and yet this is how they based their structure. We are all, this is 300 years before Roberts, we are all brethren, to no one of whom is given authority and dominion over the conscience of another. For although some of the brethren may excel others in spirituality, yet in respect to freedom and the right of sonship, all are equal. So it's quite significant, isn't there, that they were both groups of believers, Robert Roberts and those 16th century brethren, were coming to the same conclusion about how an ecclesia, a true ecclesia, should be structured. That's the significance of what Robert Roberts was proposing and pushing forward at Birmingham. Another area where he was very active was the development of the hymn book, a hymn book. Other brethren were producing collections of hymns. He certainly wasn't the first person to be active in this area. But in 1864, he produced, while he was at Huddersfield, I think, he produced something called the Golden Harp, a collection of 100 hymns. Many of them would be from the Scottish Psalter. Words only, no music, but a collection of hymns for brethren and sisters to sing. In 1869, it was expanded into the first Christadelphian hymn book. And of course, that hymn book was reprinted, revised, enlarged, and printed again and again in successive decades, incorporating music as well as words. And indeed, as one writer comments, Wesley Roberts, a professor of music, about the Christadelphian community, hymnody was an important part of Christadelphianism from its beginning. It gave independent ecclesias a broader fellowship. And this writer goes on to note how important, how uniquely in a Christian community, Christadelphians wrote their own hymns as well as adopting the hymns of others. Again, another part of the Christadelphian community, the Sunday School. In the Sunday School, Robert Roberts was a very active person in this area. He quite early on recognised the importance of teaching little ones. He, in fact, when he could, he started a magazine, the children's magazine, or the Christadelphian children's magazine, and he kept that going for as long as he could afford to do so, because money was in quite short supply at that particular period. And there is quite an endearing description by Islip Collier of Robert Roberts as a Sunday school teacher. If he addressed, Collier says, quoting from him, if he addressed the junior Sunday school, I suppose you call them, say, the infants and the juniors, he preferred that there should be no adults or superior-minded adolescents present. He might arrive home rather dirty and dishevelled, having given a somewhat too realistic description of Daniel in the lion's den, in which he had played the parts of man and lions. So something of Robert Roberts' personal style in this area, and I think it gives us a glimpse of his quite exuberant personality as well, perhaps in other areas. Well, that's Robert Roberts, aged 43, no longer a precocious young man. Robert Roberts in 1882, Robert Roberts a few years older, gives quite a good glimpse of Robert Roberts, the mature man, and his wife, Jane, at that particular era. Three of their children had now been born and were surviving to adulthood, were growing up. So there was certainly after the earlier sadness of the early years of their marriage, they were developing a family. And that's a photograph, a picture of Robert Roberts' Bible on the top right-hand side of the photograph, a much thumbed and much scribbled upon volume. Well, his work, his preaching work, continued. This is a map showing the routes he took between 1887 and 1889, lecturing tours in America and Canada. Three times he crossed the Atlantic and back, came back again, each time engaging in quite an extensive lecture tour of America and Canada. However, not everything went successfully for Robert Roberts at this particular time. He may have had a very sure touch in spiritual matters, but alas, that sureness of touch didn't extend to financial matters. This is actually a $100 share of the sugar venture of 1889. This represents the low point, the lowest point of Robert Roberts' business ventures. When we refer to his business dealings, we're not talking about business on his own account. He lived barely within his means, even on the editorial salary that he was given, and he was unfailingly generous in his dealings with other brothers and sisters. There's a story of him actually giving his watch to a poor brother in order to tide this brother over a very difficult patch in his life. He said, "I don't really need this. Take it." Presumably, it was a pawned watch. It became a pawned watch. That was an illustration of his attitude to wealth and money and so on. But he was always conscious of a need for finance in the service of the truth, knowing that money was in short supply within the Christadelphian community, relying, of course, as we do, on donations. Particularly, he recognised the need for preaching tours, and also for the expansion of the magazine. There was a great demand for reading matter within the growing Christadelphian community. There was this magazine for children that he developed while he could. There was also a reading companion magazine that he developed as a general reading magazine with profitable material in it for brethren and sisters to read. And there were other projects that he knew with his fertile imagination could benefit the truth. And so when he was in the United States, in one of his trips there, he listened perhaps rather too closely to a couple of American businessmen who claimed to have invented a way of using electricity to refine sugar. And they sold him shares in their venture, a series of quite valuable shares, if indeed there had been anything in their invention. However, it proved to be something of a damp squib on the basis that Roberts obviously didn't realise that if something sounds, as we say today, something sounds too good to be true, it usually is. He was rather taken in, and the company collapsed with all the shares, the finance, and a great deal of money was lost on behalf of the Christadelphian community. It was a time of great worry for Robert Roberts, and his health suffered as a result. Well, if we could refer now to some of the activities that he was involved in, public debating was a feature of the Victorian age. That's a picture of a typical debate happening in the open air. But more often than not, these debates took place inside, in halls. And Robert Roberts became involved in a number of debates. For example, a debate with the Plymouth Brethren on the subject of the mortality of man mortal, a reply to a book by Frederick William Grant of the Plymouth Brethren. Then there was the Bradlaugh debate. That's the title of the pamphlet that was produced afterwards, 1876, with Charles Bradlaugh, a leading sceptic of the time, on Is the Bible Divine? Another debate, Three Nights, during April 1879, Anglo-Israelitism refuted a debate with Edward Hines. Another debate, there were several others, but one in particular we should note was a debate, was Jesus the of Nazareth the Messiah? In 1871, the transcript of a debate with Lewis Stern of the Anti-Jewish Conversionist Society of Birmingham. And apparently this debate, unlike perhaps many of the other ones that he was engaged in, was a mutually respectful discussion, debate. As one writer puts it, this debate marks the beginnings of mutually respectful relationships or relations with Birmingham's Jewish community, which continued in the 1880s when Roberts called on the Christadelphian community to support Lawrence Oliphant's appeal for funds for the Rosh Pinah settlement at Al-Ja'una in Galilee. And in fact, this settlement, this appeal and the support for it, predates Zionism, which didn't really happen until the end of the 19th century. And it's the beginning of a very close association between the Christadelphians and the Jewish community. As even today, we have our Jewish Relief Fund, which is the direct descendant, if you like, from this first activity helping the Jewish community. And this is often seen as a high point in the influence of Christadelphians. In 1877, copies of a pamphlet, Prophecy and the Eastern Question, was sent to members of Parliament, and a reply was received from the Prime Minister Gladstone, one of the perhaps most distinguished Prime Ministers of the 19th century. And he says, "Sir, allow me to thank you for your tract, which I shall read with great interest, for I have been struck with the apparent ground for belief that the state of the East may be treated of in that field where you have been labouring. Your faithful servant, W.E. Gladstone." Quite an accolade, if you like, for the beliefs of the Christadelphians. Well, this is a description of Robert Roberts during this period, 1892, aged 53. This is a journalist's impression of him as he was participating in a debate. Just, if I could just quote from the middle of the first paragraph, "He holds his Bible with a peculiar, confident grasp and turns its leaves with the readiness of a man who looks upon it as a lifeline." And he talks about this journalist, his authority, somehow his personal authority that he had as a leading figure in his denomination. And when Robert Roberts saw this report, his response was, rather gruffly, "No authority, claims none, and feels none, confidence based on reason." So again, this is an indication of how he claimed no personal authority for what he was saying. And perhaps we should recognise here his labours as a writer. It seems on one count that he wrote something like 64 pamphlets and books over a period of 40 years, including the 12 lectures that we referred to earlier. The second edition was produced in 1862, and it's been in continuous print for 146 years down to this day, running into several editions. There was the Declaration of 1867, which was in fact produced by Brother Bingley of Chicago. Robert saw its potential, its usefulness, and that also has has been continuously in print, a very useful publication. Then there were collections of exhortation, Seasons of Comfort, Further Seasons of Comfort. And then there were these other books, familiar titles, titles which are on many shelves, many Christadelphian shelves, Ways of Providence, Visible Hands of God, Nazareth Revisited, The Law of Moses, The Ministry of the Prophets, and so on. One could also mention numerous pamphlets. So in that sense, Robert Roberts has given our community its literature, as that writer said that we quoted at the outset. But of course, it wasn't all plain sailing for Robert Roberts. We saw earlier his problems over financial matter, quite unwittingly, causing him a lot of distress, personal distress. And there were controversies within the Christadelphian community. In 1864, for example, his brother-in-law, George Dowie, began advocating the view that there was a supernatural devil, and there was a division over that particular matter within Robert Roberts' own family. Then in 1873, the renunciationist division, which was caused by, amongst others, Edward Turney, renouncing what had become, or what was, accepted Christadelphian teaching about the nature of Christ and the significance of his death. And that led to two pamphlets from the pen of Robert Roberts, The Slain Lamb and The Blood of Christ. And then in 1885, the Inspiration Division on the question of, is the Bible holy or partially inspired? Again, a brother, Robert Ashcroft, advocated partial inspiration in a magazine that he produced called The Exegetist. In fact, I've got Peter Southgate gave me a very rare copy of the first edition of that magazine, which perhaps some of you might like to look at afterwards. The Inspiration Division is seen by many as a very key event in the development of the Christadelphian community. And then the third key controversy of Robert Roberts' life was in 1893, the Immortal Emergence Division, which was over the state in which we will be resurrected, and the degree of resurrectional responsibility depending on whether we have obeyed our knowledge of the truth. And that led to a division. Brother J.J. Andrews had to be withdrawn from. He was the leader of those who doubted resurrectional responsibility in certain circumstances. And these controversies led to the development of a statement of faith that quite early on Robert Roberts had been developing, particularly in the Birmingham Ecclesia. And in 1886, there was the Birmingham Statement of Faith following the Inspirationist division. And then in 1898, almost the last year of Robert Roberts's life, while he was in Australia, he agreed to an amendment to the Statement of Faith covering the issue of resurrectional responsibility, which has become known as the Birmingham Amended Statement of Faith, which I believe is the basis of our statement of faith in the Dawn Fellowship, although we have a few additional articles on the question of divorce. And after all this experience of controversy and division, this very sad and distressing, personally distressing series of arguments and debates within the community, Roberts produced an article in 1898 where he tried to distinguish between disputes about important, vital matters and things which were less important, on which we perhaps might have to agree to differ. And he wrote an article called True Principles and Uncertain Details, probably one of the final articles that he wrote before his death. Well, as a result of all these troubles and stresses and so on, his health began to decline. And largely at the behest of his fellow brothers and sisters, it was suggested, or one of the reasons for the suggestion, that he should make a preaching tour to Australia, New Zealand, in fact, a tour around the world, ending up in America, which he did in 1895 and 1896. He was alone. His wife didn't accompany him on this occasion. And that's actually a photograph, a picture of him in Australia in 1896, aged 57. And then he went on to engage in a second voyage to Australia in 1898. And this is a photograph of Robert Roberts just before embarking on that voyage, looking out of that window with his two daughters, Eusebia Roberts and then Sarah Jane Roberts, with her hand on the shoulders of Amy Wilkes, who was actually a maid in the Roberts household, but obviously a very highly valued member, perhaps almost a family member. She accompanied Roberts, his wife, and his daughters to Australia, and she did actually marry an Australian brother. Is it Harold Galbraith, I think it is, and they settled in Australia. And in fact, he described this photograph as Noah's, you see that little inverted commas, Noah's Ark, a picture of Noah's Ark, for Noah removed the covering and looked. Something about that photograph reminded him of Noah coming out of the Ark. In other words, it marked a new beginning in his life because he was intending to actually settle in Australia. And that actually is the root of his second voyage, not only to Australia, but within Australia and his travels up and down New Zealand as well, quite extensively in New Zealand. And in fact, a house was acquired for him for Robert Roberts and his wife and family in Melbourne, Orient House, Coburg, Melbourne. And just to give an idea of what these voyages involved, this is the SS Alamanda in Sydney Harbour. That was a ship, the boat that he was going to, he actually crossed to New Zealand in, and I think he may well have then gone on to the United States on this vessel. You can see it was a sailing ship with a mast, with an engine, a combined steamship, sailing ship, a very seaworthy vessel, but not particularly comfortable, a comparatively small vessel. He wasn't travelling in sort of luxury liners, accommodation when he travelled by sea, particularly when he arrived at Australia. In fact, he describes in his diaries how quite often he was the only member, the only passenger on a ship who wasn't seasick, which he attributed to the fact that his father had been a sea captain. But that gives you an idea of the kind of stresses and strains that these sea voyages probably entailed for Robert Roberts. And the idea was now that Robert Roberts would return to the United Kingdom, to Britain, without his wife, leaving his family behind, engage in preaching in Britain, and then return to Australia eventually. In fact, this is a very interesting piece of paper because these are his scribbled notes, a proposed lecture advertisement for lectures that he was hoping to hold in Birmingham. It's quite a good example of his writing, his quick longhand, and the way in which he was planning ahead, even then, for further preaching. And in fact, that was the route that he took from Auckland, New Zealand, to America, to San Francisco. This is a final photograph of Robert Roberts, taken in March 1898 at Coburg House in Melbourne, the final photograph of Robert Roberts. A rather sad photograph, isn't it? Showing him as an aged man, 58, 59 years of age, someone who had laboured long and hard in the service of the truth and who was showing the effects of that labour in this rather line drawn face. And one reason for that sadness was that as he was about to embark on this final voyage to America, he received a letter from F.J. Janaway telling him of the withdrawal of fellowship from his son, Edward, by the South London Ecclesia. And he wrote a reply in haste. In fact, I've got a facsimile copy of that letter, perhaps one of his final letters, written in haste, because presumably the boat was about to depart, showing his powers of expression, how he could be eloquent, writing in haste, expressing, as one writer said, a reserve of spiritual strength in a time of great sadness. And all of that one can see in his face in that final, rather sad photograph. And in fact, when he arrived at San Francisco, he fell asleep. He died in the Cosmopolitan Hotel in San Francisco. He had a heart attack, we believe, on the 24th of September, 1898. And perhaps the news of what had happened within his family, that rather sad news, may well have contributed to his final death. Alas, his wife was left behind in Australia, and she returned to Britain. And this is a rather nice photograph taken some two decades later, in 1916, of Sister Jane Roberts and her granddaughter, Edith Ladson. Well, Robert Roberts was buried in the Greenwood Cemetery, New York, beside the grave of Dr. Thomas. You can see from this quite nice modern photograph, it shows his tomb on the left, and these are the words on that, the inscription on his tombstone, which I've copied on the left-hand side of this slide. Here lies Robert Roberts of Birmingham, England, etc., etc., who for 40 years was in the front ranks of the Christadelphians, aided and continued the work begun by Dr. Thomas, by whose side he now sleeps in Jesus. Well, in conclusion then, when we look at this epitaph to this great servant of the truth on his tombstone, we can see, can't we, in retrospect now, what we referred to at the beginning of this address, his providential organizing role within our community, a crucial role. Rules, institutions, and even the literature of our community. But it was more than just that. We remember him for his great personal qualities as well, his record of service, of faith and sheer devotion to the Word of God. Well, finally, perhaps we could just finish by quoting those words from C.C. Walker, the brother who actually succeeded him as editor of the Christadelphian upon his death, where he summed up the life of his great friend and predecessor. And he quotes, in making this statement, this rather nice statement about Robert Roberts, he quotes from an epitaph to another man, and he applies it to Robert Roberts. It might be said concerning him, if thou seekest a monument, look around, for he did much to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. He did much to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. And to the extent that we are prepared, a people prepared for the coming of our Master, we are a fitting legacy, a legacy to the work of this remarkable man. Thank you.